Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, three main themes emerging. The first theme, more of the same as three retail titans bring out earnings for this last week, and they continue the same trends that they'd been seeing over the past few months. Second trend, new accounting practices. And the third trend, blaming the weather. Please rate our podcast wherever and however you listen. The feedback certainly helps us out. And please check out our YouTube channel for new episodes as well. Also, feel free to reach out to us on Twitter or Instagram at Retail Podcast. Now, later on, our interview guest will be Cardlytics CMO Danny Cushion. She's appeared on the show just about 6 months ago, but this time she'll discuss analytics surrounding Mother's Day retail spending in the U.S. and, of course, Mother's Day just last weekend. We lead our show, though, in the news portion with Walmart, as they reported earnings on Wednesday of this last week, and many analysts seem pleased with the results, but the stock actually fell in trading on Thursday. Now, Walmart's stock has fallen pretty consistently since all-time highs from late January. They've been talked about as the one retailer to adequately invest in e-commerce. I don't know that we agree with that. There's a lot of other retailers investing in e-commerce at high levels, but because of this, Walmart's bottom line has been greatly affected opposite their growing e-commerce segment sales, and the first quarter earnings report proved to be largely successful for the retailer as those e-commerce sales numbers did grow sequentially.
Walmart has been a retailer that has been in the news almost every single month, either because of a new acquisition or a rumored acquisition. And I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about Walmart and their first quarter earnings report. And this is for fiscal 2019. We have to remind everyone that they run 1 year ahead of the calendar year. But this quarter was very important for Walmart, as they showed that year-over-year e-commerce sales is still growing at a fairly fast pace, 33% in the United States to be exact. Last year's fourth quarter e-commerce growth had slipped to 23%, with gross merchandise volume increasing 24%. So obviously you have those third-party sales that are to be included in there, and that's what the gross merchandise volume represents. And you can see 33% growth, that is what made headlines, Trent. I think a lot of people were excited about that figure because they grew sequentially, they grew year over year, a lot to be liked there. A lot of people were saying that, well, maybe they should have hit 40%. Year-over-year growth. But to be honest with you, this is a fairly robust number in the face of all the talk about Amazon. Minus Flipkart, all of their acquired e-commerce businesses are now factored in to global e-commerce revenue. So no more talk about a new company coming aboard on that top-line sales mark for quarterly figures. Speaking of global sales, currency translation hurt Walmart top-line revenue for this quarter. We remember back to last week's podcast where Fossil's accounting reported a positive currency impact from all of the global sales they bring in. And another retailer we'll be talking about on this podcast also experienced positive currency translation, that being Home Depot. The total revenue without these currency impacts hit $122.69 billion, over $2 billion more than Thomson Reuters consensus estimates. We should note that if we include negative currency impacts, they actually more or less matched those Thomson Reuters figures. So interesting note there that not a lot of media outlets are talking about, but same-store sales are still looked at as an important metric for the company. And as we move on to those domestic same-store sales, we can see that those all-important U.S. comps hit 2.1%, which beat expectations of 2%. And I emphasize the 2.1 as though to say they did a really good job, but they did beat expectations and they beat company guidelines as well. They were anticipating around the 2% mark, but overall, this was a function of higher traffic to their stores by about 0.8% year over year and higher ticket by 1.3% too. But they didn't mention what categories won out besides groceries. There was not a lot of transparency on this call, Trent, and that's something that we didn't like. Doug McMillon wasn't on the call. They only had one investor relations representative to field a ton of questions, and you can go through the transcript yourself online and see that not a lot of the questions directly got answered, but new leadership, at least at Sam's Club, may be paying off after all. Comps there rose 3.8% on healthy traffic of 5.6%. This quarter did exude benefits from dozens of closures that happened earlier in the previous fiscal year. Many of those clubs, over 60 or so, were said to be underperforming and dragging down overall comps. Still, though, total revenue did end up dropping for the Sam's Club segment, and so did average ticket. And that average ticket is a little bit worrisome because despite comps rising, that was on the back of only traffic increases. Tobacco sales at Sam's Club did decline, so perhaps that was a big part of it. A lot of convenience stores are seeing actually a slowing trend in tobacco use. Therefore, Sam's Club may not be having as many tickets to ring up in their tobacco segments. Those sales have been a huge driver for Sam's Club historically, and honestly, it's a huge credit driver as well. A lot of people utilizing their in-store credit, which they also get some money or royalties off of. And while cigarette use is slowly decreasing in the United States, still roughly 40 million people or 40 million adults still use tobacco in one form or another, according to a report by the CDC last year. Meanwhile, certain retailers like CVS Health have stopped selling products altogether, which in theory should actually do well for Walmart or Sam's Club. International Walmart sales ended up increasing 11.7% on a constant currency basis. So you look at that figure and compare to their e-commerce growth here domestically, they are no longer a retailer that is really relying on international growth to fuel overall company growth like they were 6, 7, 8 years ago when they were going into different regions in Africa, Eastern Asia. All of those markets, very important to the company, but really, though, their focus has transitioned more to the United States.
And in part because of those robust international sales and what you talked about with e-commerce sales and U.S. same-store sales going up 2.1%, adjusted earnings per share also beat expectations with the $1.14 per share. This was a 14% increase year over year. GAAP earnings per share, though, fell 28%. As all of those one-time costs with acquisitions and restructuring brought about by all the e-commerce acquisitions brought down net income, which is something that we talked about on the lead of this story. The absolute net income figure was $2.13 billion versus $3.04 billion during the first quarter of last year. Tax reform helped bring about a 5-cent per share benefit, so Walmart, another one of the retailers that benefited from the tax reform, Walmart ticked in $5.2 billion in free cash flow, or in other words, 32% of the $16 billion Flipkart stake cost. The closing of the Flipkart deal is expected to happen by the end of the second quarter and cost the company about 25 to 30 cents per share in full year earnings. Of course, it will, at least the company says, pay off in the long term as it strengthens Walmart's international holdings in terms of e-commerce. And speaking of Flipkart and international operations, Walmart formally announced a plan to combine their UK subsidiary with another grocery chain in Sainsbury. They'll end up with 42% of the combined business. They're also divesting banking operations in Canada and Chile in order to focus on what they called their core retail capabilities on the call. Let's take a look now at domestic sales for Walmart. As Leighton mentioned, their average ticket was up this year. Last year, it was a different story. Their average ticket was actually down during the same quarter of last year. E-commerce in the U.S. was in line with expectations. Growth has been inconsistent, but they look to gain traction now that they've improved and streamlined some operations. And despite sales growth in all areas domestically, their investment did cause a 3.1% drop in U.S. segment operating income. Now, we do have to factor in those higher wages that we've talked so much about over the last 2 years as a cost of doing business, even though they are constantly trying to iron out efficiencies in payroll and scheduling at Walmart. Despite modest wage growth, some longtime associates have experienced less flexibility because of newly implemented systems, and this can wear down employee morale even when you are raising wages. Employee morale is a function of so many other things besides just those wages. Now, some other details from the call. Only, as Leighton mentioned, Katie Bruner from Walmart's investor relations teams was on the conference call. This surprised us, quite honestly, as we figured someone from the Walmart front office, other than essentially a spokesperson, would be available to field questions on the conference call. But she was able to answer analyst questions regarding an array of topics. Some of the questions didn't get completely answered. And honestly, if you were on the call, as we were, I think you walk away from it although the numbers were great, feeling a little bit disappointed at the lack of insight into the business. The biggest question we knew was going to be asked was whether or not they see the e-commerce sales growth continuing through the rest of this year. And the answer was more or less cloudy yes. Momentum, they feel like, is strong. In particular, the online grocery sales are looking to stimulate overall app sales for the company. Now, Walmart is still bullish on expanding curbside pickup to another 1,000 locations by year's end, and the 800 locations overall they look to have for same-day delivery that we've talked about on previous podcasts, most notably the podcast where they were breaking ties with Uber and Lyft and maybe shuffling that same-day delivery service towards other services. But together, this would mean nearly 3,000 locations that either offer same-day delivery or curbside pickup in the United States. That number will only continue to grow as we hit fiscal year 2020. They feel like U.S. brick-and-mortar comps could have been beat to a larger extent, in fact, if they had better weather at the end of the quarter. This is something that all retailers this week blamed, except for Macy's, which was interesting. Specifically, they said general merchandise sales were hit hardest with the weather implications, a largely colder than average March and April certainly impacting them. It's benefited some retailers, as we've talked about, like Tractor Supply Company, but not enough seasonal sales in terms of things like rock salt, for example, for Walmart to overcome the loss in general merchandise sales because of the colder than average weather. Particularly, and they didn't mention this in specific on the call, but particularly we have to feel like their seasonal segment took a hit, and especially lawn and garden. Now, despite site improvement with the website redesign, they said they still have work to do, they feel like, in order to make their online experience better, and we couldn't agree more. To us, Walmart.com feels too similar to that previous design that was causing a lot of friction. And finally, Leighton, pricing investment, they said, is going to continue both in-store and online. Even though they are experiencing a real uptick in fuel costs, they cited increased trucking market rates. It was just last month where we cited double-digit increases in diesel fuel costs, and those increases, they haven't gone away in the last month. The tax reform will supposedly allow them to go through the pricing investments, and with those recent base wages of $11 that were rolled out.
As I had mentioned last week, I am a resentful shareholder of Walmart. I own a few shares, and shares of Walmart, ticker WMT, are down over 3% since pre-trading levels on Wednesday as they closed around $83.64 a share on Friday. So their price-to-earnings ratio, if you look at the stock right now, based on that share price, is arguably appropriate, around 28 times previous year's earnings. And we see that their dividend yield is actually getting more and more attractive as the share price drops from the all-time highs in January, around a 2.5% dividend yield now. And you see, the company, for some people, might be a buying target because you saw shares in late January go above $105, now around $83. Perhaps there is room to grow, especially if they keep that momentum, as Trent had talked about, with e-commerce sales throughout the next couple of quarters. Will we move on to our next story? And keeping along the same themes that Trent had mentioned at the top of the podcast, they are back and back with more of what we would call a consistently inconsistent result. This latest mixed bag makes us wonder about the efficacy of their shorter-term strategies. What the Motley Fool said was a disappointing quarter for JCPenney was just that, in our view at least, a very disappointing quarter, as shares fell over 13% in pre-market trading on Thursday on their first quarter report. Like with Walmart, shares were trending up before the official company release. Positive rumors had been put to rest, though, after that release came out. While we have been bullish on a turnaround for the company for about 4 to 5 quarters, we have been careful not to expect any massive sales growth as the company has been cutting costs and grows their online assortment. We've actually been pleased with a lot of the initiatives they have been bringing to the table, especially during the holiday season where they increased their toy selection. They announced a closing of a longtime distribution center here recently, and additional corporate job cuts, around 300 or so, and a few extra store closures here and there that they cited were either too small or underperforming locations. And since the first quarter of 2017, they've closed around 140 stores, I believe 143 in total. Last quarter, we spoke about their inventory sell-off and a margin hit as a result, and we thought it was necessary in order to clean the stores out. You don't want that stale inventory bringing your margins down and really taking the space and new merchandise coming in. And as for all that new merchandising and seasonal selections to make their way in for the first quarter and the second quarter, it looked as though they actually pulled the trigger a little bit too fast, as sales ended up getting a little worse despite all the best efforts and rhetoric within the company. Not only to blame was the fact that they only had 860 stores versus the 1,000 they had this time last year, but some of the marketing initiatives really failed to create any sort of momentum for the company. Total revenue for the retailer fell 4% year over year to $2.58 billion. Expectations from analysts were around $300 million higher than that. Same-store sales within company guidance, though, something everyone is failing to mention, just like with Walmart, but still below the 2.1% that Wall Street so-called experts were expecting. And we love how people cite these experts when the 2.1% figure actually came in on the high side of company guidance. The company guidance, for those wondering, between now and the rest of the year was between 0 and 2%. So the 2.1% that Wall Street was expecting was beyond company guidance. So we can't really expect that necessarily. We were expecting to see flat to 1% same-store sales growth. Even though we aren't analysts, we were thinking that between the supply chain lead times getting a little bit better and maybe some of the slower traffic trends for the retailer could bring it down below 2%, but up above neutral, despite the company's newer CFO appointment and a clearly stated mission to reduce its debt load. People were surprised to learn that the company actually ended up having less cash on the balance sheet and more debt. They ended the first quarter with $181 million, whereas last year they had nearly double that in cash. The thing that was maybe the most disappointing to us was that they seemingly went against their anti-debt strategy with around $400 million in bond sales. This ended up increasing the long-term debt level, and the company now only has $2 billion in liquidity thanks to a long-term credit line. With that long-term debt, we expected that number to end up falling below $3.5 billion last quarter, and it's just not happening. Right now, that debt level is around $4.1 billion as of the end of the first fiscal quarter.
Ideally for JCPenney, they'd be using this cash infusion wisely, not just maintaining, like with what we've seen from Sears Holdings, where they're using the cash infusion to basically just make sure they stay alive for another quarter or two. Adjusted net income, by the way, for JCPenney ticked in at a negative $69 million. Never good to see that negative, but it was expected, certainly. An earnings per share loss of 22 cents, which matches average Wall Street estimates depending on where you look. Some expected a lesser loss, perhaps by 1 or 2 cents. Now, perhaps the most disappointing insight, at least for us, was the change in long-term full-year earnings per share guidance. And I think ultimately this is what took shares down on Wall Street. JCPenney now expects a wide range of potential year-end results. They gave a lowered guidance of negative 7 cents to positive 13. And this was certainly disappointing to us, as they had just creeped back onto the positive side of the earnings per share ledger last year. Analysts had pegged a potential earnings per share gain of 19 cents. Now, normally, we would suggest sandbagging potentially with such low guidance for a company that has proven in the recent past that it can squeak by with that positive net income no matter how low. But in this circumstance, the guidance is probably warranted and accurate with this particular company. And part of that is that consistent inconsistency that we've seen. So let's talk about what JCPenney blamed to make the results a little bit negative. CEO Marvin Ellison on the call blamed a late start to spring. He also blamed colder temperatures for apparel sales woes. As Layton talked about, they brought in a ton of things like swimwear, for example, early, and that didn't pay off as the weather patterns remained colder into May, and as such, a lot of apparel stayed on the shelves. Meanwhile, leadership at Macy's noted no material difference in sales, and they actually countered Walmart and JCPenney's performance drawbacks by saying that they felt like they did a better job of potentially forecasting the weather months in advance and not ordering so many of those warm weather items en route to having positive same-store sales. So that's a tough pill to swallow for JCPenney, who had actually been doing marginally better, at least in terms of growth, than Macy's over the past few years. The women's specialty division comes in negative for February and March. This after the women's specialty division had some momentum at the same time last year. And margins, those are still being compressed for the second quarter in a row. They came in at 33.7% of sales versus 36% of sales 1 year ago. As for the full year earnings per share guidance being lowered, this was a new accepted accounting practice being implemented. This is what they blame for this. While this could be viewed as a positive, the fact that it's an external influence on the company rather than something the company isn't doing right, analysts were still disappointed by the timid profit outlook, and I think we fall into that category as well. Just because they're changing on how they account for certain things, including pension payments as well as certain revenue, shouldn't mean that they should revise it downward by this massive amount. And I think it's partially because they saw the tepid sales from this last quarter that they reported on, but they also have about a month of this quarter's results also that they're seeing before they reduce their guidance. And I think they're not seeing what they want to see there, particularly with some of this stuff that isn't necessarily as seasonal. We talk about seasonal merchandise, things like swimwear being ordered, for example, and those not flying off the shelves as previously thought because of the colder weather. But they also have some evergreen item categories that just haven't provided the momentum that we thought and haven't provided the momentum that a lot of analysts thought. Categories like appliances, for example, which should be growing robustly for JCPenney at this point in time, as a lot of people have a lot more income to spend. A lot more expendable income usually means upgrading on appliances, but we're just not seeing that with JCPenney, and we're not seeing the toys fly off the shelves now that it's not the holiday season either. Now, there are positives here. I don't want to be completely negative on JCPenney, and we ourselves are pretty bullish on the overall ideas that Marvin Ellison brings into the fold. We kind of ceased our bullishness about a year ago, as it seems like some of their positive initiatives have started to level off outside of the appliances that I've already mentioned. Ellison on the call started to sound like a broken record a little bit when discussing the underlying bright spots in the company's business. His confidence comes from the same areas they've been touting for years now, or in the case of toys, several quarters. Sephora was a positive, appliances a slight positive, and toys also a positive. And in fact, Sephora, jewelry, men's, and salon, all positive categories for the quarter. But you'll notice that their bread and butter isn't in the positive. This would be women's wear in particular. Sales and weather trends, as we mentioned, they blamed for this last quarter, but they improved towards the end of the reporting period. And so they're hoping that that's going to create some positive momentum through quarter two. Although, again, I don't think you're going to see that big of a cut in earnings per share guidance if they didn't see more positive momentum than what they are currently seeing. So I would caution against this positive momentum they're supposed to be seeing. Margins are expected to be better in quarter two and quarter three as well. It will be a balance, though, between promotion and profit seeking. We feel like they could be better on the marketing front, but so often marketing includes promotion, which is going to erode margins. And they're going to be using enhanced volume versus square footage metrics, markdown optimization, sufficient purchase and allocation initiative, and pricing analytics to kind of hone in on these gross margins to make sure they don't take too much of a hit. Selling, general, and administrative expenses, this was a good thing, came down 270 basis points in the quarter, or $112 million. And despite having slightly higher long-term debt, the company did have less interest expense this year than they did last year by about $9 million. So certainly that's a positive.
One of the things I had mentioned earlier was the fact that they ended up having a $400 million bond sale, and a lot of people were scratching their heads wondering, why would they have a bond sale when they've been talking about decreasing their debt load for the company? Here we have several quarters now where their interest expense has gone down, and that does a really good thing for the bottom line, for cash flow in particular. And this is cash flow that the company needs to have better merchandising initiatives and to really be able to fund their pricing measures and promotional activities. But while this happened, we have to look at maybe the strategy behind having an increased long-term debt load. And we have to dig in to what it means for the company, maybe midterm here. They were able to actually pay off $190 million worth of notes recently using the free cash flow, which is why they ended up having less cash on the books this quarter. Now, using about $400 million in those senior notes that I just talked about to actually pay off some principal balances that were due in 2019 and 2018. So through 2020, they're actually going to have not that much coming due in terms of maturities. And what those senior notes do, it's actually kind of interesting because they end up extending out the debt maturities through 2025. So it gives the company a lot more short-term liquidity. So again, it's short-term liquidity that is needed. And I think even though they may be paying a little bit higher interest rate on some of those debt securities, I think in the end, it's going to end up doing the company a greater good. And they're essentially trying to open up short-term liquidity by refinancing previous debt. And with what little is coming due in the next couple of years, they feel confident, or at least the new CFO, Jeffrey Davis, does about their free cash flow position and their ability to pay any outstanding balance through 2020. There are still some maturities out there, and Jeffrey Davis, as we remember, was appointed in July of last year and has been a huge player and really an outspoken executive in terms of saying their strategy out loud, saying that they need to pay down debt and they need to save on interest expense. Also cutting down on SG&A and all of those expenditures really is coming from the top down, or Jeffrey Davis down. He ended up coming from Darden a year ago, and he served as their CFO and has done a lot of work not only in the FSR industry, but also the retail industry in the past. And a lot of those initiatives seem to be paying off. Again, he was brought on board to help with SG&A, and as Trent mentioned, it really helped in terms of the 270 basis points they cut off this quarter versus last. Lastly, with the positives, they expect the second quarter comps to be much better than the first quarters. I say much better, modestly better, up around 1% to be exact is what they're anticipating. Shares fell dramatically this week. Ticker JCP trended up prior to the release, just like with Walmart, but they ended up hitting around $3.10 a share prior to earnings and then collapsed all the way back down to around $2.60 a share, where they sit at around the end of trading on Friday. Same song and dance for the share price, as it's been fluctuating greatly between $2.50 a share and $3.50 a share. This has been happening for quite some time now, Trent. The stock's been extremely volatile, and as a current shareholder, it's really making my patience run a little bit thin.
Well, that's all for the first news segment of the Retail Focus podcast. Coming up, an interview with Danny Cushion, the Cardlytics CMO, who will discuss analytics surrounding Mother's Day retail spending in the U.S. We should mention that Cardlytics also reported earnings a couple of weeks ago, and their earnings call was fantastic. Between that and an announcement we'll talk about in the interview, boosting their overall market cap by about 40%. We've mentioned in previous years just how big of a boon to some retailers spending surrounding Mother's Day can be. And of course, Mother's Day this past weekend. And joining us to talk about Mother's Day spending, particularly in the U.S., is Danny Cushion. She's the CMO at Cardlytics, a purchase intelligent platform that mines a lot of data and has a lot of interesting stuff in terms of their findings, not only for Mother's Day, but a lot of other different categories. Danny, thanks so much for joining us again on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me on again. I love the podcast. I'm always happy to be on.
So first, as kind of a refresher to our listeners, where does this data that you guys have at Cardlytics, where does it come from?
Yeah, good question. We see about $1.3 trillion in spend in the U.S., which equates to about 18 billion transactions. And where that comes from is we run cashback loyalty programs for about 2,000 banks in the United States and the UK. And so if you were to go into your bank's mobile app or online banking and you see offers from retailers, from restaurants, from subscription providers, from entertainment brands, we run that program. We are the white labeled program for all of these different banks. And so as a result, we have an aggregated view of all of the purchase data from these banks. We don't have any personal information. We do not hold PII. That still resides within the bank. But since we provide a really compelling cashback loyalty program for banks, we have a really interesting view into how consumers are spending their money. And so for retailers and marketers, we help them reach consumers through these really secure, high-scale bank channels based on how they have purchased in the past. So I'm a mom of three, I'm a working mom. The kind of cashback rewards and offers that I see in my mobile app are different perhaps than what you would see, what your sister would see, what my sister would see. It's all personalized that you're getting cashback on the things that you love. So since we do see this aggregation of spend across credit, debit, ACH, and bill pay, we love to look at, we got a bunch of data geeks in the building, self-included, and we look at trends of what's happening across categories, across holidays, and how are people spending their money, and where are trends shifting.
Now, I know, at least for us on the podcast, Leighton and I are both heavy users of these cashback programs, so certainly we probably factor into the data just a little bit here. Now, getting to Mother's Day, how big of an impact does Mother's Day spending have on the overall retail landscape?
It's pretty significant. I think particularly with Mother's Day, some trends that we do see, we actually see that people don't want to muck it up. People care a lot about spending on Mother's Day, and the kind of spending that we actually see is done more in advance than it is for other holidays. So we actually see a pretty good spike happening a week prior, 2 weeks prior, and there is a really nice bump around sort of the Mother's Day, Father's Day, grad time frame. As we look into specific categories of spend, we really are able to isolate that it has a pretty nice bump on overall spending.
Now, I think one of the most interesting things about the data that you guys are able to bring to the table regarding Mother's Day is the regional breakdown in the U.S. Just how did the regions break down in terms of Mother's Day spending, not necessarily in terms of how much spent, although that's interesting as well, but in terms of what regions are spending on?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll sort of layer it first with what we're seeing from a macro perspective. I think we have seen the typical spend on things like clothing and jewelry and, you know, candy. And for the most part, people are spending about $46 on their mom. That's on average. Obviously, jewelry ranges way higher, to the tune of like $196 in the West. I think it's about $160 overall. But we do see it filter down differently in different regions. So the South spends a ton, actually 41% of their Mother's Day spend happens in the South. Right. So the South is very heavily a brunch culture. And so as we break down a little further, we do another little cut of 41% of Mother's Day spend is happening in the South. They love their mamas in the South, but 48% of that is at restaurants. There's been a shift not just to experiences and things like increased spending at spas, increased spending on the movies, a pretty heavy shift to meals out as well. And if you think about it, you know, people still love to give their moms stuff, which is always well received and, you know, good news for retailers too, that is still growing and doing well. But there has been a really, really significant increase in spending on experiences. Now the Northeast, if you look at, so while the South loves to go out to eat, the Northeast is actually spending more than anywhere else in the country. We do think, of course, that's more of a function of the fact that prices are higher in the Northeast. Not that they necessarily love their moms more than anywhere else, but we do see them spending more on taking their moms to the movies. In the Midwest, shoppers are spending the least, but again, we'll tack that down to cost of living and prices. And then in the Northeast and the West, there's a pretty big splurge on jewelry. So again, West coming in at the highest at about $196 on the jewelry purchase is the average. So it's a pretty significant Mother's Day gift.
Now, it's not just in terms of how these different regions are spending their money, but also it's an issue of when. And I noticed that you noted in your data that some regions slowly ramp up spending, some regions procrastinate in terms of their spending on Mother's Day. How did that break down?
You know, overall, again, I think there's a lot of preparation versus other holidays. The South and a few other regions like that are typically out ahead of the game. The Northeast are the biggest procrastinators. Don't know if that is a function of it being very busy in the Northeast. Not sure. What we are seeing, though, is with the procrastinators, there's a pretty heavy slide to in-store purchases on the late end. So if you're thinking about you go in and you grab some flowers, you grab some candy, you grab some, you know, sort of a last-minute gift. And I think there's an interesting takeaway there by region or not, really across the country, knowing that there's a lot of last-minute shopping happening in-store. And I think people do forget that, you know, as much as online has been growing, in-store purchases still make up more than 90% of purchases in the U.S. It's still massive. So making sure that as a retailer, you're thinking about what can you do at the point of sale? What can you do in your stores? What can you do to make it really easy for customers who are trying to get that last-minute gift, heavier in the Northeast? But how do you make it really easy for those folks to find what they need and have a good deal?
You mentioned earlier the experiential spend has gone up a little bit, and you're seeing a lot of that, particularly in the South. You get that experiential spend. But it seems as though the people who purchase the material goods, people are going into stores, as you mentioned, and buying the flowers, buying the candy, buying greeting cards, that type of thing, they seem to spend more. How does the spending break down in that regard among people that are maybe purchasing experiences versus those that are purchasing material goods?
It's a great question, actually, because I think as we're seeing 3x the amount of spend on experiences over things, it does seem a bit counterintuitive when you look at, you know, if the average shopper is spending $46 and people are spending $160 on jewelry, 80-something on clothing, it comes down to the number of purchases. The people who are doing the last-minute shopping on clothing or jewelry end up spending higher ticket but fewer purchases, where we've seen a really big ramp in generally just the quantity. The quantity in experiences is outweighing the high ticket that you'll see for things. And so it's been a pretty interesting trend. Again, it still has some very good growth on the actual retail side of things, but it's been more of a story of quantity over price.
I know there's never just one simple answer to things, but at least looking at it from the retail perspective, what are some things that retailers can do to try to cut back into those experiential gifts again, where they might be losing market share just in terms of simply number of spends?
Yeah, it's a great idea. And actually, a colleague and I were talking about this earlier today, because we do work with a bunch of different brands who do advertise through our bank channels. And so we're constantly having conversations with CMOs about how do they drive their market share. Since we actually can see market share, we can see the brands who are doing it well and those that aren't. This isn't just about Mother's Day, right? The retailers that we see winning in this space, the clients of ours that are doing this very well, are not just thinking about a one-off holiday strategy. They're thinking about engendering loyalty along the way, getting people familiar with the brand, and making it really easy to shop with them. So obviously back to school is coming up. The December holidays are coming up. Planning now and making sure that they're top of mind when that shopping behavior pops up is really important. And then as much as online is growing, really thinking about how the omnichannel strategy rolls out. The retailers that we see doing this very, very well are the ones that lower all barriers to entry for their customers. And so it's not easy. It's a really easy thing to say, what is your omnichannel strategy? You know, brands that we see doing very well here are companies like Target, you know, and it's Target. Target is Target, but they do a very good job of making it very easy for customers to shop online and go in store to pick up. And I have a friend who is moving, and she's told me recently she's done so much shopping on Target lately because she can buy stuff online, go into the store to pick it up. They drive her to the exact location in the store, and when she's there, she picks up $100 worth of other stuff. And so the retailers that are doing it well understand the dichotomy of online to offline, offline to online, and how those things work together. So again, it's not just about Mother's Day. It's around how are customers shopping around holidays, and how do you make it easy for them by lowering the barriers to entry.
As you look at this study and kind of step back a little bit, we've talked a little bit about some of the trends within the study, but in terms of other trends, is there anything you're seeing from the data that suggests perhaps something else bubbling to the surface, maybe other takeaways that retailers could have?
One of the things is, as we talk about barriers to entry, the retailers that are understanding this well are, again, it's all about making it easy for the customer. It's a similar trend, but when you think about where they have spent their media dollars in the past or where they've spent their marketing dollars, you know, there's still FSIs happening. There's still a fair bit of couponing, but having to clip something out and bring it to the store or download yet another app or take a picture of a receipt, customers are just too busy to do that. So again, using those that actually have CRM data and using it to their benefit to understand when their customers are shopping and how to drive them back in are doing very well. We do see that just across the swath of customers that we work with, not just from a retail perspective, but from a restaurant perspective, with luxury brands, travel brands. It has got to be easy. You know, the program that we run through our bank partners, you just go in and you put on the offers that look compelling to you, and then you swipe your card, you get cash back. Not saying that's the only way to be able to reach customers, but it's got to be really simple. People are busy, and we do continue to see spend and market share increase for the brands that really get that.
I want to close out with this, if we can. You guys mentioned as a company last week, and I announced this, that you were coming out with a partnership with JP Morgan Chase. What's that going to do in terms of bolstering the sheer amount of data that you're able to collect and also the value you're able to bring to the consumer?
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's an exciting announcement for us. It's still early days. We did just announce the signing of a 7-year contract with Chase. We're going to be bringing out our cashback rewards programs to Chase customers in the future. For us, it's exciting because the biggest brands in the world need to be able to reach customers at scale, and it's obviously going to give us more opportunity to reach more customers across the entire U.S. They're the biggest bank in the country, so it's a big deal for us. But really, it's a big deal for customers and for marketers as well to be able to get their message and their offers in front of more eyeballs, right? More customers with the things they love to buy. So, yeah, thanks for flagging that. It's an exciting time for us.
Fantastic. Danny Cushion, once again, the Cardlytics CMO, their purchase intelligence platform, talking Mother's Day. Thanks so much for joining us again on the podcast.
Thanks, Trent.
Well, we thank Danny for joining us once again on the Retail Focus podcast, and we'll actually be back with another Cardlytics interview here in a couple of weeks. We'll talk about the grocery industry and where that stands through the first few months of 2018 in the United States. But we continue with our news portion here on this episode with Home Depot. Get this, guys. Home Depot had a miss on Tuesday. Not only a miss, they missed on two numbers. The first time this has happened in several quarters. Home Depot missed on revenue and same-store sales, but they did see yet another profit beat, which is what we've come to expect from the home improvement retailer. Home Depot has had a remarkable run-up over the last few years. Their stock is up 67%, in fact. Over the last 3 years, Home Depot and Lowe's have both taken advantage of website development with omnichannel investment. They've also taken advantage of pricing power and an ever-growing contractor network. Between remodels and new multifamily development, Home Depot has provided a sort of brick-and-mortar safe space for investors still looking to have stability and an okay dividend. Home Depot, in fact, did just raise the quarterly dividend by 16%, now paying $1.03 per share. Now, shares, like with many companies we've talked about recently, including Walmart, have hit all-time highs as recently as January of this year, down slightly on this announcement, in part because of the couple of misses, but still a lot to like about Home Depot, just maybe not as much as previous quarters.
When the media says that results came in light, it is most definitely relative to this retailer's previous level of success, because Home Depot has been killing it quarter after quarter. And those recent all-time highs in January, Trent, they can't sustain. Even if you miss just a little bit, they're going to come down. I think shareholders are really holding this stock in high regard. And I think it says a lot for the company when a lot of media outlets come out against the retailer for a quarter that, if this were any other company, would actually look fairly good. Sales were expected to rise another 6% over last year's first quarter, but instead only rose 4.5% to $24.9 billion. Same-store sales for the Home Depot increased 4.2% globally and 3.9% in the U.S. You have to take a step back there and see that 3.9% in the U.S., that is a fairly low mark. At least in the recent past, they've been able to bring in 5% comps. And you see that is a slowing in growth overall, and you have to look at what's to blame there. But we wouldn't have been surprised to see those comps come in around 5 or 6% as they have been. You see the average ticket for the company increased 5.8%. Transactions decreased 1.5%. Again, taking us back a little bit. We were anxious to see the notes about the comps, considering other retailers are blaming a somewhat cold February and March timeframe. Earnings per share, like we said at the beginning, did end up beating versus analyst expectations, albeit by only 0.9%, coming in at around $2.08 per share. $1.67 per share was taken in last year. Expense discipline and an aggressive and constant share buyback plan help the earnings per share number. As always, Home Depot is buying back a lot of shares, and we should note that they're actually in the midpoint stage of a massive $15 billion share buyback program right this second. They had an absolute net income figure of around $2.4 billion, which is funny enough, it almost matched the revenue prospects for JCPenney this latest quarter. As we dig into the details, a couple months ago, leadership said they were actually excited to see the newly passed tax legislation, as a lot of retailers were, and they saw it as a net positive for everything that surrounds their business. And Home Depot has always taken a more transparent take on political issues and issues abroad as far as the economy goes. And they saw this as a net positive for housing, which we take to mean single family homes and multifamily. And this really helps several segments of the U.S. population. The upper middle class families are going to have a little bit higher demand in single family homes because of a little more bonuses being given out, a little more discretionary income. And home and apartment builders arguably will have more capital to invest because their tax base is a little lower. So in theory, it's going to help all parties. And this is going to help Home Depot because obviously the supplies and building materials are going to be needed to build these permanent structures. However, the home improvement space is only getting more competitive, as we've seen in recent years, with a lot of regional home improvement retailers actually doing quite well on comps, and interest rates are going up. So a lot of different things coming to the table for Home Depot, along with fuel prices, which could end up eating into discretionary income for some of those middle-class people out there. And obviously, modest wage increases have helped a lot of people maybe deciding to actually partake in that home improvement project they've been putting off for several quarters now. The average rate in the U.S., just for everyone out there to know, for the 30-year fixed mortgage this last Wednesday was 4.78%. And we mentioned this because they had actually mentioned this in February when they talked about the tax legislation that was passed. The average rate in all of 2017 was 4.1%, and the company said that they actually anticipated that going up. So potentially you have a positive effect from people getting more taxes back, but a negative effect in that they're going to be maybe putting off a new home purchase because they don't want to pay the higher interest rate relative to the last 2 years, where interest rates were maybe sub 4% in some cases. Potential home buyers are becoming more aware of this, and a lot of historical data actually says, you know, we're in Home Depot's favor in that they're actually suggesting there is little to no correlation between new home buys and interest rate movement. But I would beg to differ. I think if the rate goes up another 1 or 2%, a lot of people may be putting off that new home purchase. We must also figure that home renovations can occur a little bit more when home equity lines of credit are cheaper, and those rates are also going up, just like the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. Those HELOCs are going up, and I think that a lot of people may be putting off the bigger home renovation projects if that continues. As far as weather concerns, analysts did seem to think there was a legitimate claim for Home Depot, and the longer winter, as far as it affecting sales, CEO Craig Menear echoed this in his opening remarks, indicating that there were, in fact, several weather-impacted core categories. Menear and six other executives were on the conference call, giving us some pretty good insights into the quarter and how they thought the rest of fiscal 2018 was going to play out. Strengths in the contractor business, as they ended up outdoing do-it-yourself customers in sales, and they ended up seeing success in 2- and 4-hour delivery pilot programs that catered to their pro business as well. So a lot of positive influence from these contractor programs that they've been pushing out, just like with their main competitor in Lowe's.
Throughout their entire business, they see customers adapting to what they call an interconnected retail strategy. This is basically what other retailers call omni-channel, but they did see online sales growth of 20%. And Leighton, I know you recently bought another refrigerator in-store, but you were able to shop mobile a little easier to compare brands and prices versus other retailers. There was, however, in your experience, a glitch on in-store inventory, and I think if I recall correctly, you had to end up calling the store, which kind of erodes the entire point of omnichannel as well. Free delivery, also, they typically offer a week out that also beats out Lowe's on average in their 2-week offering for most models. They've been slowly adapting Home Depot as service functionality with online purchases, which allows customers in certain markets to attach installation options. Management gave an option of a sink installation option so as to represent one type of item that isn't too cumbersome on the conference call. And I recently visited a store, actually a couple of stores, that had antiquated signage. And I noted this as I was shopping at the Home Depot. It was very interesting. The store looked like it was straight out of the 1990s, but that looks to be addressed with a series of long-term priorities for the company. During the first quarter, they did a major refresh package in almost 250 stores, We contend that Home Depot has the money to make this happen at all of their 2,285 stores, or at least the ones that are in dire need, as were the ones that I visited. There was also a constant theme on the call of employee and customer enhancing investment. If you haven't gotten the idea yet, they talk a lot in buzzwords on their earnings call. In-store tools to make associates better equipped, for example, to handle the layperson request, but also big contractor orders, because you do get such a wide spectrum of customers coming into a Home Depot. They want to try and equip their employees a little bit better. And Home Depot has always been bullish on making sure their employees are correctly trained, basically calling that the cornerstone of their business. And Layton, I know when you and I have been to the store recently, the Home Depot, at least in different locations, employees have used things like a store search tool on their own phone and that type of thing. So that helps to quickly direct customers, certainly whether they be some of those contractors or the lay people going in. And they did mention investment in the mobile experience and how it's paying off so far for the company. Just how it can be measured, you ask? Well, conversion was up over 10% across all devices over last year. That is a pretty big hop in terms of conversion numbers. Now, Craig Menear ended his comments by thanking the staff and mentioning that, again, employee training crucial to some of their initiatives. But what seemed to hurt the top line and same-store sales the most was seasonal. Layton asked kind of an open question earlier where he said that what categories might they have that would be impacted by a cold first quarter? Well, of course, we know lawn and garden going to be one of those areas. They went deep into explaining that seasonal in the first quarter typically accounts for about 15 to 20% of sales. They ticked in negative seasonal comps this quarter due to that pesky weather in their northern division, which is their largest by store count, and also some colder than average weather in the south, where they typically would be starting up those garden or seasonal sales. We did mention, though, how earnings per share beat. Well, that happened despite noticeably higher costs for lumber and building materials. They were able to pass some of that increased cost onto the customer, though, which helped that average ticket comps that we discussed. Positive categories remain somewhat consistent. We say that even though last quarter, nearly every single category was in the green. But you look at the categories that had success this past quarter: flooring tools, interior doors, bath fixtures, storage, paint, locks, security. A lot of these, other than locks and security, are things that, again, people do when they have that expendable income and they feel like upgrading, and things like paint or upgrading their interior doors or putting in new flooring in a bathroom or kitchen. And again, flooring and tile, a big driver here for Home Depot. Locks and security, a very interesting thing among other bigger ticket categories like heating and air, which again, something that you can do when you have access to that low interest rate HELOC. And as Layton mentioned, those might be going by the wayside.
To keep traffic high, they're looking to capitalize on the holidays that are coming up for the second quarter. They're going to be offering special pricing on a number of different items. They didn't say what items. They're kind of keeping us in suspense there, but they did say what holidays they're going to be celebrating with that special pricing: Memorial Day, Father's Day, of course Father's Day, and the 4th of July. Again, they will all take place for the second quarter, so look for that to maybe bump up at least traffic, which was, again, down for this latest quarter. They only opened one new store for the fourth quarter, and that was in Connecticut. With 238 million square feet now, they average $412 per square foot per year, and this is up 4.5% over last year. So you can see those same store sales increases really have helped their sales per square foot. And like with JCPenney, forward guidance takes into account all the new accounting standards. I have to account for revenue in a different way now, and earnings per share is expected to hit $9.31 per share, which is actually close to the $9.50 mark we saw from some analysts. We see some analysts expecting low $9 and some that are expecting high $9. So unlike JCPenney, you see that those new accounting standards aren't really changing the fundamental expectation for the business's profit. Home Depot has become known for an increasing full-year guidance mark as the year progresses, so we expect this to maybe be the case if the second quarter promotions pay off. Shares, ticker HD, ended up falling 2% in Tuesday's trading after the news came out. We see from $191 a share to $187 a share where the shares ended up being on Friday. All-time high in January, like we said, was over $207 a share. Right now, the company sits with a $216 billion market cap, almost as big as Walmart. While not as big in terms of the market valuation, they certainly are more of the focus niche in retail with plenty of midterm potential, whereas Walmart, a lot of volatility built into that stock over the last 6 months. And in our last story, a new employee tax in Seattle could affect more retailers than just Amazon. The Seattle, what they call head tax, as it has been called in the media, has garnered a lot of attention for how it might affect Amazon and Starbucks. But there are a number of companies that could fall into the tax in one way or another. We have to delve in to see exactly what this tax is about. And we see that this tax is actually a compromise for the tax previously floated by legislators. The first tax proposed a $500 per employee tax. The tax passed this week with a 26 cent per hour levy on employers for each full-time employee on payroll during a quarter. The city of Seattle estimates that this will generate around $47 million per year. Full-time employees are defined as working 480 hours or more in a particular quarter, and employers will have to pay this tax quarterly, although it is said that some will be able to pay this annually. The money is said to be going towards homeless services and affordable housing, which has plagued a lot of metropolitan communities as of late. In 2015, the homeless situation in Seattle was declared a state of emergency, and the Seattle Times reported that on one particular night in January 2017, the homeless population was said to be 11,643. I would not want to be the one counting each homeless person. On a per capita basis, this ranks sixth among cities with 600,000 or more people. Washington, D.C. was the worst with 110 homeless people per 10,000 in the population. So this amounts to generating a bit over $4,000 for each homeless person in Seattle if this tax gets processed appropriately. Prior to the tax passing, Amazon came out against it and even halted construction on a large office building in downtown Seattle that would house around 7,000 employees.
Now, construction on that building has since restarted, but an Amazon spokesperson mentioned that the tax forces Amazon to question further growth in Seattle, and they also mentioned a hostile approach from the city in terms of business and job creation, as one might see, certainly from a business that employs a lot of people in the Seattle area. Let's take a closer look, though, on the retail front at who might be affected outside of Amazon. The Seattle Times, after a Freedom of Information request, acquired a comprehensive list of companies that will be impacted by the tax, or companies, in this case, that bring in more than $20 million in revenue per year. Now, 77 total retailers, including car dealerships, are on this list. This includes non-store retailers, among which Amazon is one of the six on the list. Proponents of the tax argue that only the top 3% of Seattle employers will be hit. So again, if you hit that $20 million revenue threshold in the city of Seattle over the course of a year, you're going to be hit by this tax. And Nordstrom, which is based in Seattle, should also feel an impact as a retailer. The Seattle Times astutely noted that grocers could also be the hardest hit as they carry a large amount of revenue but slim margins. And as we were looking at this story, that's kind of the first thing we brought to mind, as grocery stores usually have a store revenue that's fairly high, but again, their profit margin a lot slimmer than some of your businesses like, say, Home Depot, or even businesses like Dollar Tree, who we've mentioned is having some robust margins in the past. As we look a little closer, the city of Seattle has at least two notable chain grocers that we talk about often on the podcast. They've got Albertsons, Safeway, as well as Kroger Holdings and QFC and Fred Meyer stores that'll both be impacted by the new regulations. Seattle Times also noted that 11 food and beverage retailers will be subject to the tax. A number of these could fall into what we consider convenience stores or other smaller outfits. This doesn't include restaurants, which are lumped in with hospitality. 14 restaurants overall are estimated to be included in this by the Seattle Times. Walmart notably doesn't have a Seattle location. This much is well known by Seattle residents. If you ever talk to a Seattle resident, you can ask them whether or not they have a Walmart in the city limits, and they almost universally will tell you, no, they do not. It's almost a source of pride for some of them. Their nearest location is in Bellevue in Factoria. They've got three locations overall in King County, but not Seattle proper, so they won't be affected by this particular tax. And additionally, we recall that Sam's completely exited the Seattle Metro in their latest round of closures that we discussed earlier on the podcast. Among other grocers, Whole Foods is definitely among them that's going to hit this $20 million threshold, at least based on last year's taxes, as would Costco be impacted. Sprouts just opened their first Seattle location, but it's officially in Mill Creek, so Sprouts probably won't be affected as far as grocer is concerned. And Aldi and Trader Joe's, probably over the $20 million mark in revenue per year as well. And this is something that, again, we just have to eyeball and see that might be the possibility since they are a privately held company. But Trader Joe's, a massive footprint in Seattle. And I would be willing to bet certainly that they will be over the $20 million mark with some to spare. So, Leighton, as we talk about the impact for retailers, what does this all mean for the retailers? Well, I think the biggest thing is it could impact employees, much as the same legislation that we saw on a national level regarding healthcare did a few years ago.
Could definitely impact employees, as the tax is levied on employees working 480 hours or more per quarter. So again, you look at a lot of companies and what defines a full-time worker, a lot of people may actually end up having to work less than that minimum. So you see that the 480 hours per quarter comes to around 37 hours per week. Employers, particularly grocers, may elect to keep employees under this 37-hour-a-week threshold so as to avoid the 26-cent tax per employee. Additionally, one wonders if there aren't games to be played in order to keep employees from reaching the hourly threshold. A lot of employers may look at an employee and say, well, we were considering them for a full-time position, but now because of this particular tax, we are no longer looking at that for an option. Tracking employees may be a little bit tricky in that once a salaried employee is allowed to work from home, let's say from Microsoft or Boeing, how do you track those hours? Are they going to meet that threshold? Retailers may seek to push full-time employees' hours down to around $479 per quarter to keep from paying the tax. Unlike other companies, office-based businesses, call centers, and so forth, retailers can't just pack up and move on, especially in the case of convenience stores and grocers who have to remain where the people are. You may see the destination retailers like Nordstrom, if their headquarters weren't in Seattle, move to suburbs who do not charge this particular tax. And although we don't cover them on the podcast, it would be no surprise to see most car dealerships in Seattle seek perhaps to relocate, although these businesses typically have fewer numbers of employees than a full-line retailer. But overall, Trent, a lot of questions have to be answered from the city of Seattle in regards to both the employees and employers, and I'm curious to see how this plays out over the next 6 months to a year.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I look ahead at a story we're keeping an eye on over the next week or the next month. We begin with Leighton.
We're all familiar with Campbell's Soup, and this would normally be a story on the Defunct Food Focus podcast, but this actually hit my radar thanks to listening to NPR on my way to work here recently. The CEO just suddenly, abruptly retired after being at the helm for around 6 years. Campbell's Soup CEO Denise Morrison retired, and this raises a lot of questions for the company. It raises a lot of questions for retailers as to where the company is going to be headed over the next few years. You see that they've actually been making a lot of different acquisitions over the recent past. And because of those acquisitions, Trent, they've actually been able to diversify their product portfolio a little bit more than was originally anticipated. Years ago, soup obviously made up the majority of their portfolio. And just back in fiscal 2011, you see that soup was 42% still of sales revenue coming in for the company. And now you fast forward to 2017 and you see that it's around 27%, whereas baked snacks make up a larger piece of the pie along with simple meal kits. Meal kits obviously going to be a big growth driver for a lot of companies, and I think Campbell's is really taking part in that, but not doing as well as I think a lot of shareholders were wanting. What's interesting, Trent, about this company is that the shareholders, or at least the majority of shareholders, are still on track to be the descendants of the original founder of Campbell's Soup. And So they're collecting dividends. They may not want all of that change to happen. But what is interesting is you see this retirement. Perhaps they see that they're losing ground in terms of just the shelf space they keep with grocery stores in general. It's diminishing over time, and perhaps a big change is needed, and maybe they're okay with putting those dividends off to the side. After all, this year, they're on track to collect around $175 million in profits.
My looking ahead story comes via the farm and home sector. Now, typically, we talk about a retailer like Tractor Supply in this area, but I'm going to talk about retailer Orscheln, who we just heard this past week is looking to expand further and further into Texas, and this begins with a Texas grand opening of their Sherman, Texas store about 70 miles north of Dallas this weekend. Now, they're rolling out all the stops for this grand opening, but what's even more intriguing is they've got a lot of marketing materials geared towards introducing their brand to Texans, as they say they want to expand further into Texas with increasingly more Texas stores. Now, Orscheln stores are located in multiple different markets, both large and small, mostly throughout the Midwest and the Southern Midwest. They're based out of Missouri, but it could be the case that they're seeking to expand to more states and more regions as they go. It's kind of a race against Tractor Supply, who normally sets up in larger markets than does Orscheln. And I'll be anxious to see who ends up winning this fight. There are a lot of entries in the farm and home market, and a lot of them regional. If you're in the upper Midwest, certainly you know about a retailer like Rural King, who would be a lot larger in terms of overall store footprint than most Orscheln stores or most Tractor Supply stores, both of whom are usually under the 40,000 square foot mark. So it's worth keeping your eye on as we continue to see growth in this segment. We talked about Home Depot seeing growth in things like locks, for example. Well, Orscheln, one of those retailers that does have a lot of merchandise in terms of not only safety and security, but things like gun safes, for example. So it'll be interesting to see how they play out with other businesses that operate in the same farm and home sector, like, for example, a Tractor Supply, but also how they compete against businesses like Academy, which have such a strong foothold in Texas. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week. Remember to like us, rate us, however you do find us. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast and at Retail Podcast on Instagram as well.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.